you know, I want to thank George for asking me to do this. And, you know, initially I was telling Maria outside, my first instinct was to start to go over things. And I didn't need to, but I just wanted to come straight from a place of honesty, which is not my usual place growing up, but we'll get to that. I want to welcome the newcomers. Aurora, hello. And the rest of the posse from Ventura. So, without further ado, this is kind of a two-pronged attack for me. There's two phases to my, or many phases to my life, but all of it grounded in the conditioning that I call it, the conditioning that I got when I was, I really think it started, I don't remember much before age five, but I know that my parents, my dad was an Irish Catholic, a professional fighter, and they came over, I don't know, you know, this is the beauty of all the dysfunction. They carried all of it. I mean, the lies, the secrets, the don't talk, don't think. That's what I was given as I was growing up. And I'll share some of the things I saw that was just horrible and terrifying. But, I mean, not physical stuff, but just what I interpreted as what's wrong with me in the end. So they came over from Pennsylvania. No explanation. They just said, yeah, we came over from Pennsylvania. I guess I'll get into it now. I was to find out later. I was in my 30s, and a gentleman came to the door and knocked on the door where, I don't know why we were all together, but I opened the door and it looked just like my dad, and lo and behold, my dad's name was Paul, and his name was Paul. And I said, what's up? And he goes, I'm looking for my dad. And I thought to myself, yeah, so am I, let me know when you find him. But he was in the other room, and I said, well, come on in. And I was to find out, we were all to find out, we were like, there's four kids, I'm the third, there's four of us, and he had a family of five in Pennsylvania. Nothing was said, no one ever said anything to anybody. Nothing was told that he had a family. In fact, when his son was leaving, my sister and I were like, we didn't know what to do as far as making him feel comfortable, because it had to be really uncomfortable. And I remember him leaving, and my dad never said a word. I said, what's up? Ah, don't think about it. And there was a lot of animosity with my dad, and we'll get into that, obviously. But my dad was a periodic alcoholic, and which made, I wish he was just a steady alcoholic, because I grew up my whole life waiting for the other shoe to drop. I was always in fear. Fear was my number one drug. My mother was incredible, but she had arthritis. I really believe all of this I'm going to tell you about my mom, I know for a fact, was psychosomatic. She died at 62 from just the realization of what she got into. She came from Pennsylvania, very just a loving, kind woman, beautiful woman that everyone saw as what she was, very loving. She couldn't hold me, she couldn't nurture, she couldn't do anything of that nature. In fact, you know, the communication skills weren't very great then, so she couldn't even really, she never said anything to me other than the things I witnessed of don't think. Don't think about it, just let it go. Which is tough, because I just want to bring up a time when my dad was just going off on my mother, who was just ironing. We had nothing, but as a kid, I didn't think about it. I had cardboard in my shoes, in my tennis shoes, but I didn't care, because it just didn't dawn on me till later, when the shame and everything else started, the abandonment started really hitting. But my mother really couldn't hold me, or she didn't tell me anything, because although she was outwardly loving towards everybody or anything that came into her, she couldn't be hands-on or really direct with things. And I, from kindergarten to 12th grade, my parents had to come in every year, because I was a little bit out there, disruptive, and, obviously I was just looking for some kind of attention, but I was good at getting it. It was just the wrong attention. So what my dad would do, being a periodic, we never knew when it was going to come. This is all the shame. And I was about 8 years old. I think it was in my chonies or something, but my mom was ironing, my dad was just screaming profanities. He was really loud. It was very tough for me to be around loud people like that, especially abusive people. I just didn't ring with me, man. I kind of went in, inward, which is what I did anyways. We'll get to that too. But I was watching him, and I was like, I had my hands up, and I was, because I couldn't figure out why this kind of vehement. He was just vicious with his MFing and a lot of profanity and blame. And my mom just there ironing. So I remember I went in the kitchen and I came back out and they weren't there. And I snuck back to my dad's room. And my dad, since the age of 15, this is just a little insight. He died at 91 smoking two packs of Chesterfield Kings. I took one once and never had one again. But he smoked two packs of cigarettes a day, but he was a drinker. And lo and behold, he worked at Anheuser-Busch. Good place for him. But, okay, so he's screaming these profanities, and I'm just looking at him, and I'm looking at her, and I'm looking for some kind of feedback. So I go away, and my dad's down the hallway in his room, and he's smoking I peek around the corner, he's smoking his Chesterfield. And I couldn't find my mom, and I was like, I was worried, because I kind of, took on a defender role. Even though I was small, I early on had a distaste for my dad. But anyways, I went down the hallway and I opened the door to the closet, and she's sitting in there. And I go, "What are you doing?" And she said to me, "Don't think about it, just let it go. There's no feeling about anything, just let it go." And I was like, really? Even as a kid. So that being said, my whole life, a false life, by the way, a false sense, if it wasn't for the fact that the false self that I was very athletic and very funny. And that was me. That was the joker, whatever you want to call it, the clown, whatever. But it got my attention, and it got me some kind of attention. I didn't know it at the time. I just needed something. I just needed someone to say something to me. And I sought that, unfortunately, most of my life. So after that's basically the whole, we would go out to eat. And my dad would have a few, more than I don't even know how many he had. But we'd go to this restaurant, and the guy knew him, and he'd start literally yelling profanities at the guy's nationality while we were sitting down, and we were just cringing. And it was a really beautiful family. My sister's beautiful, my younger brother, my older brother, but to this day, they don't, they're in the dysfunction, and it's hard to be around them. And it was hard for me, because there's a few unfortunate events that we all go through in life, but not just his family life. So anyways, I internalized everything. I went in and I suppressed, and this went off like a time bomb later on in my life, but I suppressed everything, because no one talked to me, no one explained anything, and no one said anything. The only time, and I really excelled at this, in third grade I had a teacher who was very, very loving. I don't know if she just understood things, but she was really good to me, Mrs. Lewis, and it changed. I mean, I was a completely different person with her. Unfortunately, it quickly changed once I got to the next one, because then she actually paid really beautiful attention. I love that woman. For that moment in time, she really changed my life. So my parents were coming in every year. I'm a little defiant of my dad, and I was we lived in North Hollywood, is at Coldwater Canyon Elementary. And I loved it. In the fifth grade, we moved. And so I had to go to a new school at the sixth grade and be introduced, which was like, put a railroad spike in my head. It was just, I can remember to this day, I could go back to that day, just remember the lead up to it, right? The fear before the fact. And being, I mean, once I, once I met everybody, I was fine, but I just still remembered the anxiety because I was just pushing everything down. The shame was starting to come into play. It started to come into play in junior high and really came into play in high school. But in fact, my mother would take me to school and she'd laugh because I would lay down in the back seat. It's probably, a lot of kids probably do this, I don't know. But I had her take two blocks down to drop me off down here, and I'd peek up and then I'd get out of the car. It didn't ring with me what was going on, because again, nothing's said, nothing's talked about, nothing's ever, there's no nurturing, there's no touching. My dad never really talked to me, but he never touched me. He couldn't, he just wasn't capable. Oh, my mom was, she had rheumatoid arthritis. She was internalizing the fact she came from a religious family. Not a zealot or, orthodox. Just, she was a very loving, kind woman. And I think when I was in the womb or something, the realization that things were not going to work out well for her. This guy, even though she loved him, he's a tall, handsome guy and, Mr. Everything in his own mind anyways. The reality of life is, because I don't know if it's because of the family back east or what, but we didn't have anything. And I think she realizes, and as time went on, her ankles were swollen. She never said, this is, I know this falls into a category, I just don't know what, it's codependent or what, to the extreme. But, she had rheumatoid arthritis, her ankles are swollen, and it was all because of his treatment. Maybe it was just that age, but, or that time frame. But he was never soft. He couldn't be anything but a brute. He was a brute. And this guy would go down to the local bars, call them names, and want to get into fights and stuff. And it was like, he brought that home with him. So I was always, and this, even today I'm doing this. I get up early and I'm out and I come back late. And it didn't never dawn on me until I thought about it, really. And I go, now, that, wow. I was doing that as a kid just because I didn't want to be around the guy. I just couldn't deal with his... He just never said anything. He was in his boxers and he's smoking his Chesterfields. He was embarrassing and it was shameful to me. And he did some shameful things when I brought people over. And I said, never again. And then I realized, wow, I never bring over anybody. And it hurt me because I realized that was still from him. So, at about 10 or 11 years old, he had said something to me. We were in a small apartment. I said, really? And I got his lighter and, I went under the bed and there's that stuff that hangs down, from an older bed, I guess. But I said, and I lit it. He lit it. And I could see it was catching. And I walked out and I said, I just lit your bed on fire. And he goes, what the fuck did you say? And I said, I just lit your bed on fire. I gotta go. And I swear to God, it was hilarious because I was downstairs. He's in his boxer shorts, MFing everybody, trying to get the thing on fire over the railing. And I was like, whatever. They're very defiant towards him. Just to get back, just to get in some way. I mean, I didn't do it consciously because I wasn't conscious. So I'm stuffing everything and I'm going through life from junior high to high school. I'm just saying this to, I had scouts after me and stuff, but I was a head case. I was a head case then. And, I wasn't doing good in school because I didn't have the greatest feelings about myself at all. I internalized everything. I suppressed my poor heart and it was later to explode, but we'll get to that. I went down pretty hard a couple times. So I'm going through life. I thought, my whole thing in life was to get to the next moment as fast as I could because I didn't want to spend any time with myself. Any moments with myself, let's go to this moment. Or, I thought, let's go to Europe. So off and on, I lived in Europe and Spain and traveled to mostly Morocco to smoke hash. But I just went all through there. And I had a good time, but it wasn't a functional time. I was carrying the same disease. I was turning into the person that I didn't want to turn into. And in fact, later on, it was like, wow, this person I truly hated was coming out of me in my treatment of not just myself, but just with women that I was with that, you know, showing this false self. And that's the whole thing that I went through until this program, and I thank God for this program. I really do. I was led, this was the last thing for me, I think. I mean, I just was at wit's end. You know, all this traveling around, all this trying to find, you know, whether it was money, it's so obvious, you know, when you look at it, when you have a little insight. But back then, it was just traveling from one thing to the other. Well, if I had this money in this house, every house I had, I lost. All the money I lost, all the cars I had, they're gone. Everything was gone. You know, I didn't never stop to think, well, I wonder why that's happening. I had internalized a behavior of who I was, obviously, of shame. And later on, an incredible thing of lack that came out, which I put out there, and you get what you put out there. So everything was coming back beautifully. I was losing everything, and it was okay, because I just get more. But you're going to get to a point with that where the real person has to sort of look in the mirror. And I'm embarrassed to say it. I'm just learning that. I'm just learning that outwardly I can be really loving to everybody else. And I don't know if that's my mom or what, because she was like that. But I know the power of transference. And I'm not blaming him. I'm just saying the power of transference when you're not solidified in who you are is so incredible. And I think I've suffered more from the voices, the hypercritical and the hyper judgment of the voices, to where, I mean, it was taking me down. And a quality of living, quality of life that I was living was a facade. It wasn't, you know, because I didn't know who I was for far too long. I knew I could get along in any situation. I could do anything I wanted. There's a lot of us in here through life. I got broker's license, stuff like that. So what? I can take a test. The main thing was I was living life on what I saw and what was never explained to me. And I didn't feel good about myself, even though I can get by, like I said, because I was funny and whatever. But that's how I lived my life, and it was very painful because on the inside I was dying. And I had no idea what to do. I went to a therapist when I was, and I was running on a track team at that time. It was like Laszlo Tabori, the 10th guy to run under a 4-minute mile, taught it. And it was brutal. And I'm just bringing this up just to let you know that nothing's good enough when you're not good enough. I don't care what you do. And he had a timing thing, and I said, you know, he goes, pick the time you think you can get close to. I ran a 5:15 mile, I weighed 215 pounds. And he was like, wow. And he asked me, what do you think of that? And I said, I remember this. I go, I probably could have done better. I think I should have done better, shouldn't I? And he looked at me kind of strange. And I should have been looking at myself strange, because that was my life. Nothing's good enough. You're not good enough. Doesn't matter what you do. Underneath it all is that veil of worthlessness, really. But the outer facade worked for me. So for a while, until I got to a certain point. How much time do I have? Until 8? Okay, so I want to get to my son being born. My son was born on the 14th of January, 1993. Changed everything. The love I felt was real. And I had a far greater respect for women. I think I almost fainted in the room. I saw him come out, and I go, what is all that stuff? And I kind of got like weird, you know, really limp-legged. And the nurse goes, hey, sit down. And I was like, what was all that stuff? She goes, haven't you? And I said, no. But my son and the relationship that I have, my son is pure love. The only love that I've known, and it's been commented from some of the women I knew, but that was really the purest of love. And we've been everywhere together. He calls me, we talk to each other every day and twice a day. And it's always, I love you, I love you. It's beautiful. So after he was born and being raised at seven, he was 7 years old, and my wife said, she was having an affair, so we got a divorce. But, you know, I got to tell you, and even my friends said, well, because my reaction was, I was going to therapy, and the therapist said, you know, I'm going to put a couple of pinpricks in you, and you're probably going to go into depression. It was not a pinprick. It was a railroad spike. And I went down just like a balloon letting out air. I just went, combined with that, the abandonment just came up so tenfold. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to, it was about my son. I go, I'm not going to see my son. And that's when things really, for about 17 years, got really weird for me. I went into, you know, pretty steady decline, depression-wise. I mean, I still functioned somewhat. But all the characteristics that I had learned, which I didn't learn other than dysfunction, were starting to come up. Well, we're always there. I shouldn't say that. I'm sorry. They were always there. I was just becoming aware of them and conscious of it. And I think it started when I saw my son born. I started to feel for the first time. Okay, so after the divorce, I'm going to skip ahead real quick to, the end of 2012 and 2013, my aunt, who had dementia, was on my mother's side, who had never married. She was 69 or 72, something like that. And she was starting to do things that were not right. The beginning was there. My brother lived now, this is North Hollywood, my brother lived about a mile away. I lived out here in Ventura. So I was concerned. I drove over there, and I drove past what I thought was her house, but some lady was in a crop top and culottes and some wedges. And I go, boy, what street am I on? And then I got about halfway down the street, and I go, that was my aunt. So I put it in reverse. I go, Katie, what is this? And there was some guy there from Guatemala, a younger guy, just taking advantage of her. And she was a virgin. I know that for a fact. I don't know for a fact. I mean, I know from her. What I mean is, if you knew Katie, you'd know that she was a virgin. She was a virgin. Because she was a little twisted. More than me. You know, I was always the one that could judge somebody else, but not look at themselves. So anyways, that brought on, I said, well, I started kind of looking after. I got rid of the guy that was in there. I finally caught up with him. I mean, it was a big police thing, but I finally got a hold of him, and he was gone. So, but she progressively got worse. And as she got worse, I asked my brother, hey, man, could you help me out? And my sister, I didn't hear one thing from him. And I'm not going to get into what I had to do to take her to the doctor. It busted me mentally, and it busted me financially, which is okay. It's not okay because I thought my family was going to help me, but they were non-existent. Which blew my mind until I sold the house, of course. But before that, let me get back real quick. You know, I read how many self-help books? And I was actually had enough nerve to be giving people information. You know, you ought to be doing this. You should try this. Here's a guy that's so empty. I mean, I was hollow. My heart was so full. And after my aunt, she passed away, but, you know, I did everything I had to do, and you can call it what you want, but I loved her, and I was not going to let her go. I'm just not the kind of person. Even though my brother was doing his thing, I was not going to let a person, because, you know, she wanted to be in her home, and I had to do a lot of work there, but we're not getting into that. So I'm reading all these books, and it's just information upon information, intellectualizing everything. Meanwhile, my heart, I think it's over here, I, because of the internalization was always in my head, which is not a good place. And it's the kind of thing where you would say to your mind, okay, mind, I need this done. Make sure that she, you know, is like this, or she does that, or, so I'm trying to work things out with a mind that's only there for, you know, mathematical equation or to think about something. And I, from being in, from birth was in my head, because something was wrong. Something was wrong with that family and nothing was being said about it. So I internalized everything. And I got to ACA, thank God, because nothing else, I tried everything. I studied with the Jehovah's Witnesses. I went to Scientology. Scientology is interesting. It does help because everything is in your reactive mind. So I know that sounds corny, but it really does have an effect. You store everything there, therefore everything that hits your heart or your wound, and I was getting hit, comes out through that wound. So you're just going back into that old valence, to use their words, that old personality. So I was living a life based on a false self. And that false self, you know, was an you call it whatever you want. It was an ego. It was my ego. So I'm seeing the world and getting ACA, and all this from the bowels of hell, mine, this stuff starts to come up, this darkness. And it was all my suppression. So all of this really dark, dark stuff is coming up, and I'm, because I'm in my head, and it's coming up to my head, I can only, you know, if you've ever read Tolle, it's like the pain body. It's suppressed energy, and it's dark energy. And when that dark energy comes up, it's very painful. And now I'm aware of it. So that's gone on a couple of years, but I'm understanding it more because of ACA and going to meetings, and that's the key. That book is, the genius of that book is beyond anything I've ever even opened. It's so overwhelming on the genius of it, and I thank God for it. Because it once we all see ourselves and hear from our fellow travelers, it's just like, wow, it's not just me. And that was a huge thing for me, because I always thought it was all about, not just all about me, but I thought I was like suffering in my own particular way and no one else was. In fact, I had a therapist at the time. She goes, do you think you're the only one that feels that? And I thought I did. But she goes, well, you're not. And I go, oh, okay. So anyways, a lot of dark energy. And I'm trying to separate from my mind, my head, which I created my world in, to what's really, which not just really out there, but as this stuff comes up, it's like, it's very hard to get below it and see it for what it is, which was dysfunction, complete dysfunction. You know, I stepped on that a little bit, but what it did to me as a kid was, and what it does to all of us, what we see and what we experience, it's just brutal. It's just not, it's not human. But they're my parents and they didn't know better. So, and that's hard for me, by the way, to say that, but it's the truth. If no one who is sane could possibly treat someone like that, or not treat somebody like that, I should say. So I'm around my other siblings, and it's like, my sister, she had a few beers, and she says, I'm walking across, and I had told them after the house thing, you tell me when I need to shut up. Okay, so I'm at a party with our family, and they're all giving these accolades to my dad, Grandpa. And I just stay in the corner, I don't say anything. But I get up, my sister had had a few beers, and she goes, you know, you're just like your dad. Well, that hit me wrong. And I said, don't ever fucking say that to me again. And I love my sister. But I found out the level of dysfunction when I asked them to help me. I texted them, I said, hey, I'm really hurting. I need help, please help me. It's been 3 years, nothing. I never got nothing, I didn't get a text back. My brother did deliver her diapers once, and I had to pay him back, but that's all right. Until the house sold. But I'm grateful. I'm actually grateful for it, because I got to see the progress that I got from ACA in deference to anything else I've ever done. I've prayed till my ears bled. All of that. Nothing reached my core and is making me human, who I really am. And I'm really, it's beyond grateful. But, you know, still, to be quite honest with you, I'm still dealing with it. It's still very painful for me, even with all the work, because when you stuff, when you're that, and you don't know who you are, you know, it's just tough. I mean, it's been brutal. Yeah. A false self, to realize and see in certain situations that touch that wound in me, that false self come out, which is just reactive. It hurts. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of crying and a lot of weeping, which is good, because I need to get it out. But to know that I went through life like that and I hurt people, it hurts me more than anything. And the only thing I can do because of this program is to try. I don't even have to try. That's the beauty of this program, is to be loving to everyone I meet. And I really do try to, regardless of, it's not about them. I realize now, wow, it's in me. I just am still trying to find that love, even though it's told by my son and stuff. God, you're so loving. I'm like, really? Sad, but you know what? I just keep working on it. And because of this program and some very intense meetings, you know, it comes out. It has to cough itself up, and it's like bad phlegm. It's just, it's a tough ride. I suppressed it. I get to feel it again. I don't understand that. I don't, it's hard to know when I hear the stories of what people had to go through sexually and stuff of that nature, and it just makes me ill. I really get ill, and which is, again, the compassion and love that I feel for people on a level that I never had. When I start getting emotional and maybe crying over someone else and what they went through, that's when I know, wow, you've kind of changed. Because I was more cavalier, and I didn't know what emotions and feelings were anyways. Mm-hmm. When they came up, I just went, I didn't think like, what's that? I didn't know what they were. Nothing was, you know, if you can believe that, I hope. I just didn't know. I just felt uncomfortable. So at that time, I'd either have a drink or smoke. I mean, I did 10 years at AA, which helped. But I always said AA was the weed, not the root. I got to a certain place and they said, this ain't doing it. It's not doing it. And that's when I found this place. This place being ACA. And it's a miracle. I'm forever grateful to God. I'm closer to God of my understanding. And I love people. I love everybody I see. I see, you know, that I see their face, and I actually see it for the first time when I look in their eyes, and I can see the beauty of it. I don't see the pain. I see the beauty of what's in front. The pain will go if you keep just coming back. Thank you.